artificial intelligence, we believe, is going to deliver a doubling in performance per same cost every 4 to 5 months. Imagine that you have to take one robo-taxi to the border of California and Nevada, and then get out and get into another robo-taxi because there's a difference in the rules of the road for how robo-taxis can operate. That's clearly not efficient. Kids are smarter. Literally, like, pollution makes you dumber. If you, like, one of the reasons to ride in a Tesla is because you have a good filter in the vehicle. But I think you can safely say that the tailwind will be towards, hey, this technology that is, like, better for humans, better for the world. Imagine you own a Model Y, a new Model Y, great car, with FST, and you own FST. That's the equivalent of a modern taxi medallion once if the robo-taxi network launches, right? This is, it's a moment of profound acceleration. And it has, like, in every spot that you operate and occupy, there is something that is, I think, going to be dramatically changed by technology.
There seems like there is a giant embracing of innovation, technology, and the future with some of the recent happenings that have occurred in the United States, at least from an administrative perspective, like the government. It seems like they're just giving a big hug to innovators. Elon Musk as the prime example, right? And I'm wondering, you know, since you specifically and ARC, y'all cover innovation and the future and how it's going to pan out so closely, have the recent developments in the last few weeks and months, have that has that changed your trajectory? Has that changed the way you're thinking about it? Does it validate your thesis? I just want to start there because I feel like that's going to give us the ability to go 1,000 different ways. So let me know how you're thinking about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge and understand that kind of the regulatory or the governance impulse that arises with technological transitions can hold back new technologies. It's probably like the primary risk to technological diffusion and really the profound productivity advances that we think could come from technologies. And we're at a unique time because technology is moving so quickly. So on artificial intelligence, we believe is prospectively going to deliver a doubling in performance per same cost every 4 to 5 months. This means that kind of traditional tech, it takes 2 years to get a doubling in performance per same cost. So the last 5 years is going to be like the equivalent of 25 years in traditional tech. So the tail half of this decade is going to be like living 25 years of technological history, all compressed. And certainly the regulatory apparatus does not move that quickly. In fact, it moves a lot more slowly even than traditional tech. And so you're probably going to end up with technologies that are moving more quickly than kind of like the political system knows how to cope or deal with. And so far, we've seen there's going to be a diversity of political responses. I think the EU is radically consigning itself to the dustbin of history with the way that it tries to regulate technology. They're already kind of polluting our technological lives with these stupid allow cookies pop-ups. I would advocate that tech companies should just like clip the EU population out of kind of access to their services in order to get rid of those pop-ups. And that's kind of a joke, but it actually could be optimum strategy. As in, you know, if Google's work has shown like any like marginal change in the friction to access a site results in a customer churn reduction. And so you could imagine somebody experimenting with, wait a minute, what if we just like ignore the EU law and get rid of the allow cookies pop-ups? Cutting out the EU population may be more than made up for the fact that we would get actually better commercial traction in the US or in other geographies. And so I think that now the way we model technologies, we don't try to explicitly model in subsidy or regulatory friction or we basically design as if kind of the technologies are going to speak for themselves and force the political process. And it's because kind of the politics are so idiosyncratic and it's hard. I think it's much harder to forecast than the underlying technologies because the politics are subject to the personalities in the room at the time the decisions are being made. So I think we don't directly change our forecast as a result of the change in the political environment, but I think on all kinds of vectors, it's broadly good for believing that innovation is going to accelerate, that you are not subject to as much risk from, people doing stupid things. I was in a conversation today, somebody was saying that the EU is going to consider a $10,000 to $30,000 tax per humanoid robot in the EU. Now, I don't know if that's true, but talk about how disastrous that would be for kind of just productivity and how quaint and funny it will be 5 years from now, or maybe it's 10 years from now. You'd go to visit European countries. It's like, oh, look at these people doing their own dishes. How cute, you know? And so the other thing with technology today relative to other times in history is that it can diffuse much more quickly. And so there will be clear kind of pushing from the populace against the government that, no, you have to let us do this stuff because this will make our lives better. Like, why are you standing in the way of this thing that we can see, across an imaginary line on this piece of land? These people are enjoying much better quality of life because they have access to these underlying tools and technologies.
Go ahead, Hans. You wanted to jump in?
I was just thinking about how a lot of the technologies that ARC really focuses on, crypto maybe being a great example, have been stymied here in the US over the last 5 years, especially. And the fact that I think, a component of that is that the United States has lacked a peer competitor that forced us to get our act together on some of these things. And so anyways, I was just thinking about the rise of China as a peer competitor and their focus on a lot of the key technologies, whether it's, battery technology, whether it's robotics, whether it's AI, that we no longer have the luxury of regulating some of these sectors to death. Because if we do, it's very clear and obvious that we will fall behind in our global position and our national security interests.
Yeah, it's certainly true in the AI space. Like, I think DeepSeek, in some ways, it imagine there was like a heavy regulatory kind of like smother over the development of open source AI in the US. That would not stop open source AI development. It would just mean that kind of it's more under the control of offshore entities, nor would it stop people using those models because they're very performant. So generally, it seemed like we were in a spot where kind of the AI model development space might be subject to regulatory capture towards the tail end of the Biden administration. I think that the rules were being written in a totally arbitrary and really a way that gave the illusion of safety without actually providing any safety to anybody, just denying people access to tools that would be useful and denying the continued development of those tools. And it seems as if in the US we've dodged that bullet. Now, I can't say the same for Europe. It's like, good luck, guys. I think that at a very high level, there's all kinds of reasons why there will be kind of like political momentum to try to suppress and stop these technologies. And you can see all kinds of historical examples of how that's happened. The UK, by all rights, should have been a great auto manufacturing country. But when the automobile was introduced, they passed the red flag law, which required somebody to walk in front of the car waving a red flag for safety reasons, right? And I think they had to have two operators in the vehicle. Well, okay. So if it requires three people, one of which walking to operate a motor vehicle, you're probably not going to get much use out of the motor vehicle. Nobody's going to buy it. You'd stick with a horse. And so they stuck with horses, and kind of like the automotive manufacturing center of the world was not in the UK. It happened in the US, it happened in Germany. So that is, there's the impetus is always it's safety, or it's kind of luditic concerns about, hey, this thing is going to do something that I was previously being paid to do, and so we need to stop it or tax it. And I think we will see that emerge geography by geography over time, and certainly in this political moment in the US, it's pretty clear that there will be competition between geographies, both for, geostrategic or political strategic reasons, and because of the pressure that the population places on the governing mechanisms that should allow the technologies to proliferate and grow and continue to flourish.
Yeah. I think one, like right along those lines, you know, it's funny you brought up the red flag laws, which I didn't even know that was a thing. And it's like shocking to hear a little. So they literally, it was, there has to be a human with a red flag in front of the car to make sure they didn't run over anybody, or like to let other people know. It's like, hey, here's a car, be careful. That actually happened. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It does limit your top speed if you have to be driving behind a human that's waving a red flag.
Somewhat.
And for a long time, the UK also had, I think the speed limit was 4 miles per hour. Wow. So the first speeding ticket, I think, issued, somebody was going triple the speed limit at 12. I think that it's 8 or 12. I can't remember. Wow. So that's the, you know, and they kept that in place, you know, long past it made, I think, into the 30s. Right. That's so crazy. Imagine like the Model T is like, you know, it was well after the Model T had scaled. They still had this arbitrarily like crazy low speed limit in place.
Yeah.
And that's the other problem with regulation, is it's like easy to make rules and hard to unmake rules. And that's what, you know, I think generally bureaucracy just like grows like an evolving organism.
A one-way ratchet.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the executive order on AI, you know, one of the numbers in there was any model trained above this number of flops has to report everything that they're doing and kind of get pre-approval for their safety mechanisms and stuff, which is obviously a threshold that is going to become absurd within a couple of generations. And and you could imagine it's the same with like money transfer laws. You know, money transfer laws were set at a threshold that's like, hey, nobody could possibly be trying to carry this much cash around for any legitimate purpose to, you know, buy inflation. Suddenly it's like you have to report, you know, yeah, literally like for Venmo, I think it's, you know, some hundreds of dollars that you have to then report out.
Yeah, I think it's like,
it doesn't necessarily make sense anymore, you know?
Yeah, 100% agree. It's funny, like the real quick story, and then I'll ask you sort of this question about the regulatory environment. But when we went to Mexico, we were in Cancun, and we went to Chichen Itza, and they had these roadways where they were blocked off with construction. There were these giant things that said, don't enter. But the law required people there holding flags saying, hey, there's a barrier here, don't fall asleep, right? Kind of thing. It's like, well, the barrier is not obvious enough. You need somebody holding a flag to make sure people don't fall asleep, because they had it. Anyway, it's great. Okay. So the reason why that's interesting to me is if we think about self-driving cars, and again, this is very like geographic dependent. Europe seems to be a lot more strict around this, the United States less so, the China even less so, right? But there seems to be a time now where and you tell me if I'm thinking about this incorrectly, the forcing function of the technology to drive the cost much lower is finally here, especially with the advent of vision-based systems like Tesla's doing with their cars, where the per unit cost of a self-driving vehicle is significantly lower than one with LiDAR, et cetera, and then the fungibility, or you know, the ability to pick that car up and drop it anywhere else without any additional training is basically zero because of... they're using an AI brain. They're not using map data, et cetera, et cetera. And so the thought process there is, as you yank the human out of that car, then your cost per mile drops by 60, 70, 80%, whatever that math is. Let's say a cyber cab versus a Toyota Corolla with a driver, whatever. But it's significantly cheaper, right? So now we have an equation that says, okay, driving is going to get really, really, or transportation rather, is going to get really, 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 really cheap. And in places like the United States and China specifically, at least in areas of the United States where self-driving is allowed, I think a lot of these regions are going to start to notice, hey, moving around just got really, really easy because these things are freaking everywhere because they're very cheap to manufacture. They're extremely safe. They're private, right? I'm the only one in the thing, or me and my friend, we don't have to worry about a driver in there. And they're cheaper than anything I could hail or even... anything I could own potentially with enough time. And I feel like that might drive, like, you know, like with sort of like the opening thing you went through, which is very, very helpful to think about, that's going to drive the regulation whether we like it or not. Like as long as people see that it's very, very cheap, it's going to be very hard for regulation to step in and say, yo, this is not allowed, because people are going to be like, how come I can't get to the airport for $5 instead of paying somebody $50, right? So kind of help me think about how you're viewing the like this landscape in the next coming years, because to me it feels like a done deal. You tell me, but it feels like a done deal.
Well, I mean, I think I'll stick to the U.S. where I'm kind of like, I know Europe's limits are arbitrary. The U.S. system right now, to get a driver's license, the state is issuing that driver's license. So each state can have their own requirements for who is a driver. Whereas like at the federal level, they are kind of regulating the underlying hardware. They're saying, yes, this is safe and safe to go on basically the interstates that we own and control, which effectively means the roads generally. I think that it probably would be more efficient. In fact, I'm sure it would, for kind of like the driving function with regards to autonomous vehicles to be managed at the federal level. It doesn't imagine that you are trying to get to Las Vegas from LA, which is kind of a hellish drive. You know, it's a little too long and you go through a long desert. And if you're driving back from Vegas, it's particularly bad because you've probably had too much to drink the night before. Terrible. You don't want to do it. Right. So then people fly, which is also inefficient because, you know, going through the airport and going through airport security, you're probably taking as much time to fly as to drive, but it doesn't make any sense. Imagine that you have to take one robo-taxi to the border of California, Nevada, and then get out and get into another robo-taxi because there's a difference in the rules of the road for how robo-taxis can operate. That's clearly not efficient. Like, we need to allow people to drive across state lines in these things, because or else you end up with these arbitrary kind of like geographic and commercial boundaries between states that don't make sense. And so I think that kind of a federal regulation that says, like, if you meet these certain minimum standards of safety in terms of demonstrating that the vehicle can drive itself statistically, then you have kind of a license to operate, or there's some kind of federal pressure on states to have a common set of rules that everybody can apply for at the same time across the states. The reason that's important with regards to Tesla is because if you look at our published work on Tesla, yes, it transforms the economics of the business. The two sensitive drivers in the model are, we have assumptions on costs and everything else, but it's really like, when do you launch? And then what does the scaling curve look like after you launch? Now we're at the point where the debate is just, well, what does the scaling penetration curve look like? How, since they have very publicly like put a chip on the table, they're going to launch in Austin in June with a robo-taxi service. It's my belief that kind of they won't be software limited in their capability to do this thing in a broader and broader set of geographies pretty quickly. They could be operationally constrained in that if I'm going to launch in Austin and then launch in San Francisco, I have to have kind of charging infrastructure or an operator network that can oversee those vehicles. I have to get enough people to onboard, but they are not initially supply constrained in that there's, you know, literally like, I don't know, it's on the order of 2 million Teslas in the US that could operate on this network. From the Tesla financial model perspective, every car moving onto this network could be worth, you know, potentially to them, like if you run through the math in our model, like tens of thousands of dollars in operating profit per year to Tesla, much more than they got for selling the car initially. The function that governs the financial model is really how quickly can they onboard vehicles onto this network? And if you're restricted to only operating in Austin in order to operate in, I don't know, Durham, North Carolina, where I'm from, you have to go through a Durham-specific regulatory process or a North Carolina-specific regulatory process, then you really are probably execution constrained on, oh, I have to fill out these forms. I have to demonstrate this set of, like, I've crossed this set of hurdles. And you expand kind of piecemeal by geography in a way that you'll get through it, but it imposes friction on the model. Whereas if you have like a cleaner set of kind of regulatory actions you can take to get approved to operate, then kind of you will scale the business on the basis of where you have the supply of assets that you can onboard as efficiently as possible, crossed with the population density. So they're kind of doing it already. I'm sure there's like a fair number of assets in Texas and they can own and operate that network. And then in California, that's clearly where they have the largest concentration of Teslas. So they know they need to kind of go through the set of actions that are currently on the books in California to commercialize. But like expanding from there, part of their strength is they can go, literally they could spin up a network anywhere on their current software stack without having to go around and measure all the blades of grass on every single street to understand like where they can drive and where they can't, which is kind of Waymo's approach. And so kind of Tesla is selectively advantaged if there's a cleaner kind of regulatory pathway to operating wherever they want, at least in the US, as quickly as possible. And it also kind of like would shape the steepness of the curve in terms of uptake. And so it does have a meaningful impact on at least the next 5 year kind of enterprise value that the company accrues. And then there's like a further layer of like, you know, how much do you have to spend on people? Like if you have to cross a regulatory threshold in every single state, you have to hire the person to make sure that you get through that process. And then the politicians can, a politician can basically hold you hostage. It's like, oh, you want to operate in this state, then you have to do this and this and this. And that's the entire, you know, I think second order consequence of having a heavy regulatory burden is actually you empower people to extract assets from both private corporations and from the public will for their own personal gain. And you see that happen in all kinds of episodes in history. I think that the problem with arbitrary rules, or even rules that make sense, but with arbitrary executors of those rules, which we see in LA all the time for like, you know, house building, you really are vulnerable to the whim of the local dictator, who, by implication has like all kinds of power over what you can and can't do. And so then you have to figure out a way to navigate. You have to pay some third party intermediary to like negotiate with that person, or you have to directly bribe the person. You know, this stuff happens. And so I think it's really like disempowering that kind of bureaucratic layer is broadly important for like human goodwill.
And given the fact that autonomous vehicle technology has such huge implications for interstate commerce specifically, like, do you expect there to be much of a fight on this jurisdiction by jurisdiction regulatory capture? Or do you think it's pretty much a done deal that like it's a relatively brief fight that the federal government just comes in and takes control of?
I think there's a number of different ways that it could play out. I do think that, you know, at a very high level, it's like, I want to be able to send my kids to school inexpensively in a private vehicle. This is like a luxury thing that everybody's going to be able to have for, you know, at equilibrium, less than the cost of owning their own vehicle that they're then having to drive with their kids in it to get them to school. So the very rich and wealthy can pay to have like, you know, prior to Uber, a chauffeur, a driver to drive their kids around. Now, I mean, you could stick your kids in the back of an Uber, but, you know, for our family, that's not something we're willing to do, nor do I think Uber would allow it, actually, but for good reason. You know, there's the average Uber driver, but there's all kinds of variants around that. Like with robo-taxis, you know, they're going to be bang on the average. You know, there's not kind of like the vol and variance. You know, they're going to be reliable, and you know, there's not a creep behind the wheel. I think that just will provide a lot of political motivation and pressure placed on local leaders to allow this stuff to happen more quickly. So even if it's kind of like a state by state, I think there will be reasons for states to compete against each other. To kind of let their populace move around in this way. And also, you know, if you look at the miles driven by drivetrain, selling in electric vehicles is all well and good, but actually enabling robotaxi is really what tips the scales towards electrification versus internal combustion. Right now, we're selling in these giant batteries to people, including mine. My Tesla's parked out there. It's not driving around. What a waste of a battery, right? It's not taking nearly as much share from internal combustion as it could. So a robotaxi, we think, could be utilized 45% of the time, maybe 50%. So operating on average 12 hours a day. That's higher than Elon thinks they're going to go, but I think we have good evidence base for how the network could operate in that way. And versus like personal vehicles are 4% to 5% utilized. 95% of the time they're parked. So if kind of like the inexpensive transportation service like drives battery utilization, what does it take from? It means people leave their internal combustion engine cars in the garage. What does that mean? Well, during COVID, LA, the skies were a lot nicer. Because everybody was staying inside, nobody was driving around, right? The local pollution issue of internal combustion is actually a meaningful political driver here. You know, if you can selectively shift people into robotaxis, kids are smarter. Like literally, like pollution makes you dumber. If you like, one of the reasons to ride in a Tesla is because you have a good filter in the vehicle, so you're not like inhaling the exhaust fumes from the car in front of you. Well, let's eliminate the exhaust fumes entirely. That's what robotaxi will enable, and that will also give kind of political incentive for local leaders to enable and facilitate people to ride around in, you know, electric vehicles rather than driving internal combustion that they've already paid for, so they, you know, otherwise would, you know, fight tooth and claw from being taken from them. Well, provide them with a solution that's economical and actually more convenient for those people, and they'll take that solution. And then the other thing I'd say is that, you know, people, there's this argument that it's like, oh, this is terrible because everybody's going to ride around in cars. There'll be more car use. And I agree, like you're going to end up with more traffic. And over time, roads will become a lot more pedestrian and biking friendly if the roads are populated with robotaxis. Like I don't bike around town, not because I don't like to bike. It's because I don't like to get killed. And, you know, the odds of me getting killed by a human driver are, I guarantee you, much higher even today than the odds of me getting killed by a Waymo. Right. And so kind of making a bike and pedestrian friendly community, I think every local leader wants to do that. Well, the way you do that is you take the insane humans out from behind the wheel, and you basically create more robotaxis on the road that make traffic worse transparently, because, you know, me sending my kids to school also means I'm going to send them to the movies when previously I'd be like, sorry, you can't go. You know, there's going to be a lot of induced demand. Like, I'll be happy to go across town because I know I'm going to be sitting in the back of a car instead of driving myself, you know. And so that will net kind of like slow down road transport to some degree. And even the insane human drivers won't be able to get around as quickly. So they'll be less likely to run over bicyclists. And they will selectively prefer robotaxi because it'll be so much more painful to drive in all that traffic. You'd rather have somebody drive them yourself. So there's this way in which it'll ratchet up, and kind of like the way in which cities work will transform. So ultimately, all for the good. So I think local leaders will and should enable it, but with lots of case-by-case variants. As in somebody, you know, a state governor might see a political angle on, oh, if I make a big stink about this, this will elevate me into the national spotlight such that I can, you know, spin up a pretend presidential bid. Like there's going to be kind of all of that noise, but I think you can safely say that the tailwind will be towards, hey, this technology that is like better for humans, better for the world, and like saves money out of our pocket. People are going to use it, and they're going to advocate for the ability to use it.
Can I?
You mean this is going to take a lot longer to come to Chicago and New York than Austin?
Well, maybe. I mean, and also the interstate and trucking stuff is complicated by, you know, the power of the unions and the power of the driver unions. And, you know, Tesla is currently positioning its semi as, you know, a driver-friendly system that then net makes the system safer. You could imagine the rollout there being more like, well, there's always a driver at the lead of a caravan of these things, but then you can have autonomous vehicles, autonomous trucks kind of caravanning behind this driver. We clearly have a labor shortage. It's not an easy job. Like driving trucks is like terrible for your body, probably terrible for your mind. And really it is something that people should want to kind of cede over to autonomous trucking. And there will always be, I think in all these cases, there's going to be a market for the human labor component, either in the operations center, like overseeing it, or, you know, for extremely wide loads, like for extremely technical tasks, you're probably going to have very specialized drivers. You're going to still do it on a human basis or be assigned to like directly facilitate or supervise the robots that are doing it for them. I think that that'll exist for a long, long time.
Yeah, I think one anecdotal piece here that really speaks to the forcing function of the population, they will adopt this because it just makes it easier and just life is better, it's cheaper. This might be a weird example, but I think there's a direct correlation here. So we just had our first child 10 months ago, and my wife joined this like mom's group on Facebook, like when she found out she was pregnant. So all the moms that, you know, have a due date of May all kind of like go through the journey of motherhood and birthing and taking care of the child. Okay. But now all the moms 10 months removed of having a child, they're like, I need to figure out how to lose weight because I'm, you know, it's very difficult to sort of like get back in shape, right? Half of them are on Ozempic. Half of them are on Ozempic. Okay. So what does that tell me? It's like, okay, people just want to get the thing. Just give me the thing that I'm looking for, right? And just get it to me easy. I want to get there. You know, I might have to pay a price for it, but I just want the end result, right? And so when I think about this self-driving thing, is like if you're trying to go to the movies and it's cheaper and easier to get there with a self-driving car, of course you're going to do that. Of course you're going to do it. If it's safer to do it and it's cheaper and it's faster, of course you're going to do it, right? So I think—
especially if you can be on TikTok the whole time.
Exactly.
Sure.
Exactly, yeah. Right? There's so much evidence of this, you know, and I think for some of the people that might be hesitant around the regulation, even if I think that there might be a very good case scenario for the near term. Like, let's say Elon being in the position that he's in, where there's a lot of awareness and he's clearly somebody that wants to push forward the agenda of self-driving cars and why they're good, because he's personally invested in Tesla and he wants to see Tesla succeed. But there's also a lot of positives for that to happen. Even if that didn't exist, the fact that what I just described is a reality, and the fact that the technology is coming regardless if we like it or not, it's going to happen. It's just a question of timeline. Is it going to happen a little bit faster, a little bit slower? But it's going to come regardless, right?
So, well, and from Tesla's perspective, it actually might, you know, you don't need that many state, like to crack that many states to actually soak up the existing supply that they have. Like they can selectively shift between vehicles coming off leave, and they don't even have to explicitly selectively shift, but imagine you own a Model Y, a new Model Y, great car, with FSD, and you own FSD. Well, that's the equivalent of a modern taxi medallion once if the robo-taxi network launches, right? And so if the clearing price initially is competitive with Uber, so it's $2 a mile, and you can run that, you know, vehicle 100,000 miles a year, that means the gross revenue to that vehicle is $200,000 a year. Now, your cost to operate it is probably 20 cents a mile, maybe inclusive of cleaning a little bit more. We don't know yet because we haven't seen it, but, you know, we've done modeling on it. We think cost to operate, like the CyberCab, is going to be around 12 cents. And then there will be a platform fee that Tesla extracts from that. We don't know exactly how they're going to approach the platform fee, but, even if they took an 80% platform fee off that, which would be much higher than, you know, Uber takes, but actually, you know, potentially defensible given kind of how they're going to strategically operate here. Well, 200,000, and my cost per mile was, I called it 20 cents. So that was $20,000 in costs. So I have 180 left to attribute, you know, and Tesla was going to take 80% on 200,000. So then I end up with $40,000 left. You know, the net to me as the owner is kind of whatever it works to, $30,000 or something. Okay. $30,000, per year in income off the vehicle. Okay. That vehicle is not worth the piddly, you know, $35,000 or $40,000 you paid for it. if it's yielding $30,000 in cash or in income per year, right? It's worth some multiple of the income it can generate. And so what does that mean? It means you bought a Model Y in, I don't know, the state of Illinois, and Illinois is not letting robo-taxis happen yet, but Austin is, and Austin needs supply. There's going to be an entrepreneurial dude in Texas who's going to come to you and be like, well, that's a nice Model Y. I know you like driving it around, but do you like $100,000 driving it around? Because that's what I'm offering for it, because I need to bring it down to Texas where I can get a ROI on that purchase. And so then you, the personal owner, are like, well, I do like my Tesla, but I like $100,000 quite a bit more, you know? And so the supply will go to where the regulatory apparatus is enabling it to operate for best use, which is not driving 4% of the time and spending 96% of the time parked. It's driving 50% of the time, of which, 45% is ferrying passengers around and 5% is deadhead miles or something, the best use is somewhere else. And that's where kind of just the economics will pull it. And so then Tesla will be able to actually tweak the lever on their platform fee to control how quickly supply floods into any given market. As in, you can imagine they have a lot of strategic flexibility on exactly, how much they pull out in net revenue. And they'll want to incentivize kind of supply moving into markets where they need it. So give people like a really healthy ROI on their vehicles in those markets to then pull in the supply until they can, saturate and begin to compete with even personally owned vehicles. But the first move is to basically like flood a market, kill Uber and Waymo, right? And then depending on their progress in kind of like opening up new markets, then they'll play with that lever to like make sure supply is flooded in and then kind of like expand into the newer markets. And they may even do different net revenue takes depending on the market that you're in for a period of time. I think they'll be able to, conceal behind the curtain exactly what they're providing back to you. And so they'll have a lot of ability to tune kind of the supply to where it's needed for their strategic ambitions to offer this nationwide in a broad economical way.
Yeah. So are you viewing this more? This is where like I'm trying to wrap my head around this equation. Are you viewing this more as a model where a majority of the units are going to be owned by an individual or a fleet, and then they are incentivized to drop the cars where they are? Or do you view it as Tesla is going to own a lion's share of the fleet and they're going to manage it? Because I'm on the former.
Does it matter,
right? But to me, it's like creating an incentive to outsource the maintenance of the fleet makes a lot more sense, and Tesla just takes the cut and they pull the levers for the desired outcome to be generated for their fleet, right? But I would love to hear how you're thinking about that.
Yeah, I think their initial view was that they were going to vertically own like most of the fleet, but my perception is they've evolved on that somewhat, and I think it's right for them to do so. As in, it's unclear to me exactly where they're going to draw the line. Like you can imagine, they have the cleaning robots, right? The cleaning robots like attached to infrastructure, like charging infrastructure. Is Tesla going to actually own and operate kind of like the recharge station for these vehicles? And kind of the individual owners are then going to, as part of their platform fee, then have access to that charging infrastructure. That could be a way you design it. Maybe you do that in some geographies, but even that gets kind of intricate. Like then you have to be, in the real estate game to some degree. Where's the best place in this city to like have our, charging infrastructure? And is the individual owner going to use that? Maybe. So I think there's a lot of ambiguity about what the ultimate model will look like, but there clearly needs to be a baseload fleet, and that could be Tesla owned, or that could Tesla could own a fleet of Cybercabs. Maybe they even need to do it to prime the pump on an individual market. But there will need to be a fleet of vehicles that is purely devoted to maximizing utilization for robo-taxi services. But in terms of percent of overall miles, it's not clear to me what percent can be and it will vary city by city, can be attached to that base load versus needs to be surged in from a set of personal owners who are willing to rent theirs out, but also want to retain the option value to have it for themselves when they need it. And so if you like people compare it to power, where you have baseload capacity, which is, you know, cheaper per mile because it's heavily utilized. And then you have peaker capacity because in the middle of the day, everybody turns on their AC. And so you need your natural gas plant to be able to spin up to meet that demand. That's kind of like the mental model for what's going to happen here is you'll have some set of vehicles that are kind of basically they are always taking fares except when they're getting cleaned and charged. And they can do that during the, you know, slackest period in the network, which is the middle of the night. The challenge in mobility as compared to power is peak to trough and power, you know, it might be like a doubling from trough to peak, right? Like you have base load that can occupy 50% of the market. Then you have a peak that needs to go up to double that. Again, varies by geography and weather, et cetera. In roads, the trough is 1% of traffic. 1% of cars are on the road compared to the peak. As in there's like a 100x flex between trough and peak. So, you know, in some way, like whatever that base load is needs to design somewhere above that. And so it's unclear to me what the breakdown is going to be. We're actually going to do some modeling on it to figure out kind of how the economics will play out. And net, it's important to Tesla that they can have these personal owners who are out there kind of retaining rights to the vehicle to use when they want, but then that can be induced into the market given appropriate price signal so that you can kind of flood in capacity where you need it. Waymo's economic problem right now, and I just did this work a couple of weeks ago, but in the Public Utility Commission data, you can see Waymo's utilization. If you do the right transformations to the data, you can see Waymo's utilization rate basically, and also their deadhead miles, like what percent of miles they're actually able to command revenue against. The net is they spend more than half of their time parked waiting for somebody to beckon them. And then when they are beckoned, they drive as many miles without a passenger as they drive with a passenger. So you do all that when the Waymo is available, not getting clean, charged, or under maintenance for getting flagged. And they may even be like just pulling some of them off, not like waiting out there in the middle of the night as well. So we don't know what full utilization rate is, but we know the most they can possibly be utilized right now is less than 25%. So they're spending most of their time parked, most of their time driving around. And when they're driving, most of their time driving around without an actual passenger in the seat and paying revenue. And so the problem they have is, imagine you put enough assets in market to meet peak demand. Then you kill your utilization rate because you have the assets just sitting around the whole time. So they have a bias to under-provision relative to peak. But then it means they can't be relied upon. So if it's your service that you sometimes take when you think it might be economical to do it, or you think it might be available, it's not going to take 20 minutes, that's actually a much worse competitive position than the thing that people do every time. Right. And so then that's it. So they, by biasing to under provision, it means they can't be reliable, which means they can't have enough vehicles in market to get like the density required to keep the deadhead miles down. Like if you think about those driving from like 5 miles away to pick up another passenger 5 miles away is economic death. You actually want like your next hail to come right next door to where you want the person getting dropped off and somebody hopping in the vehicle right behind them, because then you drive your revenue utilization really high. And so that's why Waymo is having to sign partnerships with Uber, because they need Uber has kind of like a distribution advantage against them, because Uber is the place people can go and be like, oh, I can rely upon being able to get a vehicle here. And then Uber can flex to Waymo for some of their base with the drivers surging in for peak. Well, Tesla is going to be able to offer that full package within an autonomous space. So even if the Tesla vehicles were the same price as our same cost to manufacture as the Waymo vehicles, which they're not going to be. I mean, there's Like, I think the sensor suite on Waymo's may cost as much as the cost to manufacture the entire Cybercab. So obviously, Waymo's going to be offsite on that basis. But also being able to offer full stack autonomous, including kind of induced supply during peak, offers a competitive advantage versus what Waymo is going to be able to offer, just because they don't have that kind of like personally owned segment that can surge in.
And I think the other thing too is because of their ability to have, because they can basically go anywhere at some point, and the fact that their cost per mile is going to be so cheap, so low, even those periods where they might have that peak to trough is 100x, right? I mean, what's to say that it doesn't open the demand, or it doesn't open some sort of market for these cabs or these things to be used for transportation of goods instead of transportation of people?
Yes.
And all
yes.
of a sudden, you're creating a brand new market. So like in the same way that you're trying to incentivize people to use electricity at night to charge their cars, now you're incentivizing people to move goods at night instead of moving it during the day, right?
Yeah. Think about why does parcel delivery take place during like the peak traffic hours of the day? That's an insane, dumb thing.
It's crazy.
Yeah. But it's because like UPS drivers would command a much higher wage if they were forced to work overnight. Nobody wants to like be working overnight.
And pair that with a bot, you know, you can do door delivery. Yeah, it's
exactly. Yeah. I think that so then that's the, you know, the way Uber tried to like, there's an overall incentive to try to like squish the utilization, to basically flatten the utilization curve. So Uber Eats, the strategic rationale there is like, you have like traffic peak, then you have a trough during the day, then another peak, and then you die at night. Right. And so just to try to lift that middle of the day up towards the morning and evening rush hour, you want to supplement with kind of basically people ordering lunch. And then you want to extend the evening rush hour into kind of like a little later at night by offering the dinner. And then I guess you're hoping that people are going to order very expensive coffee from Uber Eats in the morning. I don't know if that one works. Cracking parcels is actually a lot easier than cracking Eats. Like that food delivery business is incredibly costly because you have to try to onboard all these restaurants. You have to maintain the restaurants. You have to digitize the menus. You have to like coordinate I think it's probably a huge pain to operate and administer. And it's a big drag on margins for them, I'm sure. I think there's a much more provocative and interesting utilization approach. And yes, provide these services and then kind of try to penetrate into the parcel space. And I don't know exactly what the strategy would be to do that. Would that be like trying to induce UPS or FedEx to use your assets and you provide a bot that will deliver it to the front door? I'm not sure
or
exactly
even B2B.
How that would do.
Just moving, you mean moving stuff from business to business. Like, I mean, how many businesses operate, you know, during the night? Like, there's a lot of use cases for there just to be transport of goods from B to B, and that could be the start. And then once you have a basic bot or people that are willing to sit in the car and move goods from the cab to the front door, right? I mean, sure, there's a market you pay that person plus the cyber cab will still be cheaper than whatever option we use now, right? So there has to be some sort of middle ground where they can exploit it, but it just feels like the foundation is there for that peak to trough to be solved because of autonomous, because these move on their own, right? So it's like it's going to take care of itself almost, you know?
Well, it'll require a lot of execution, but I do think
nah. That's what markets are for. I'm kidding.
I think it's an interesting like angle that they'll be able to pursue for sure. And if you think about what it means for you, the end user, it means, you know, continued collapse in the price of delivery. It means that, you know, if you think about the Amazon distribution center, and that would be the strategic partnership maybe to go after. It's like you go to Amazon and say, hey, you know, I think it's hard to, the hard solve is the end point of the robo-taxi gets to the person's house. Maybe the person is willing to go out and grab something from the robo-taxi up until a certain time of night where it's like, you can schedule an Amazon delivery that is a same day, you know, delivery between 8 and 10 p.m. for free. And that's kind of like a intermediate solution before you have an Optimus bot that's sitting in the front seat that can take something out of the back of the car, which would be kind of silly, but might be where we end up.
before we wrap up, I did want to ask you about how you and Arc are thinking about timing of the robotaxi network launch. We've seen some interesting signals recently between, you know, it seems like the Tesla team internally, this is not just Elon saying it, but there's a lot more noise about an actual June launch of the robotaxi network in Austin. And then this massive rollout of FSD in China that has gone so well. Like, to me, that sends a signal of their confidence in the maturity of the safety of the FSD software stack for them to just let it run wild and let people do all these insane tests that they're doing in China. You know, does that accelerate your timeline on when you think the probability of robotaxis hit financials are, or are you just kind of sitting in limbo and waiting to see?
No, so prior to this year, we had, at least in our published model, if you look at the distribution of like start point commercialization, like starting guns for robotaxi, it was like 60% odds of 2025, 40% 2026. I agree that there is lots of, you know, not only did have they said first half we're going to launch in Texas, but now they've like narrowed it down to June. They've specified that they're going to do it in a way that gives, I think rightly, people a lot of confidence that it's going to happen. And I believe it will. That at the high level, the most important thing that they're doing is they're throwing more compute at the problem, and they're continuing to yield better safety and performance out of the vehicles as they throw more compute and call it human talent at solving the issue, or solving basically critical interventions. If you look at the Waymo data, Waymo in California had an accident every 70,000 miles. Now Waymo will say, and I believe them, that actually, you know, compared to other ride-hail drivers within the same context on only city streets, you know, and adjusting for the fact that like not every fender bender gets reported, but this data records every single fender bender, that Waymos are safer than average ride-hail. I think that's true. So, you know, Tesla reports out we need to exceed, you know, a critical intervention between every 700,000 miles in order to be better than human performance. But practically, it's actually, you need to not get in an accident. And that stat is inclusive of Waymos with like an operator network looking over their shoulder and trying to intervene when they get into trouble, right? That once every 70. If you look at their test fleet, and kind of the data reported out through California, they've been consistently at one every 10,000 to 20,000 miles of a critical intervention that interceded in before an accident. So you can imagine that they have, it may be that they are launching commercially at 10 to 20,000 miles per intervention. The operator network basically reduces the error rate by roughly 3x to get up to that 70,000 mile milestone. Tesla, you know, at least as they say it, they think they are now crossing the threshold with the current FSD stack of once every 10,000, or you can infer that from the numbers they've put out. And there's no reason to believe that suddenly they're hitting the wall here. Like, there's plenty of evidence in all of AI that this stuff is not slowing down, it's accelerating. Even the Studio Ghibli-ocalypse or whatever just happened over the weekend, where everybody's Studio Ghibli-izing everything. An advance in the image generation models is actually reads through to like a lot of potential advance in robotics and robotaxi, because being able to generate an image, you can invert that and use it for path planning, for simulation, for all kinds of downstream things in robotaxi. And we know they're using diffusion models already. So the fact that kind of like AI is advancing in other areas is indicative of just how much more engineering work there is to be done to make these models better on the cars themselves. So net, we think that they're going to cross the kind of one every 10 to 20,000 mile commercialization threshold within the timeframe that's consistent with commercially launching in Austin, and they're going to continue to improve from there. I think as the difference between having an intervention every 20,000 miles and an intervention every even 200,000 miles is also a difference in your ability to kind of risk going into a geography where you're not as fully tested on. Like, so that continued advance, like once they cross a threshold where it's like safer than human in all contexts within which we are testing, means you can even afford some degradation in performance by launching in a geography where you aren't, you know, like currently tested, knowing that kind of it's going to continue to improve as it's in that geography and kind of like more fully ingest the data and mapping of that geography. And it just gives you like more confidence in your ability to scale without taking up too much of your risk budget. And then that just a bridge to China. Yeah, it's clear the system is wildly performant because they're able to launch it in China without even training on local Chinese data, just off data that they've managed to scrape off the internet because of China's restrictions on.
Definitely has huge implications for their ability to do training and simulation, like that they were able to translate publicly available data into such a performant model.
Yeah. And just the generalizability of their system. From a financial perspective, I think the China business will just not be nearly as good. As in, I think it'll help sell vehicles. I think it'll help with their margin and competitive stance in China. I think that they will need to, they won't be able to take the same economics in China that they're able to take in other geographies because the Chinese government will, you know, force them to partner. There'll just be like all kinds of pressure around how that business operates that probably will prevent it from being as lucrative as it is in other geographies. And that's how we model it. So I think it's a good signal of kind of the capability of the system. I think it helps local competitiveness and just like the auto sales and kind of margin. I think for them, it's like the US market is theirs to win and it's a highly lucrative market. And then in other geographies, there will probably be some geographies where they do manage to penetrate and dominate. And then somewhere, going back to the regulatory side, it's like, is the Korean government really going to let a foreign manufacturer totally dominate the robotaxi market in Korea? It seems unlikely, you know, but maybe they'll be able to license. Like, that would be the reason Tesla would license the technology to another manufacturer, is because, you know, they know they can't actually get the juicy economics that actually they rightfully deserve because of kind of like
just
just the regulatory body that's in place. And so they share some of the economics with a local partner, which then, you know, effectively deals them in from a political perspective. And then they still get even higher margin off of it because they're not having to do any of the operations or management of the underlying assets. So kind of like their ultimate, kind of the marginal dollar is very valuable for them, or marginal, you pick your currency, Korean won. Probably same with Japan. And it does, like, they probably still have like data they're extracting out of it. So it helps not only Robotaxi, but Optimus and kind of the development of those models.
Awesome. Brett, thank you so much for coming on. I want to be respectful of your time. We have to have you back if that's okay. There's so much to talk about. My God, it's like such a wealth of knowledge. Such interesting times. We didn't even talk about humanoid. We didn't talk about crypto. There's so much we can talk about. But real quick, tell people where people can find you. X, wherever, Arc, all that stuff. Give us all the plugs, my friend.
Sure. So I'm at Winton Arc on X and usually post provocative charts. I also host the FYI for Your Innovation podcast for Arc Invest. So please subscribe. We have, you know, all kinds of,
especially if you're a truck driver and driving the truck is rotting your brain, this is a good way to counteract it.
Yeah. Yes. Listen to me at 2x speed. That's my advice. Arc-invest.com is where all of our research lives. We have an amazing research team. We have a big ideas report that, you know, covers all of the technology areas that we cover. And I do think that it is good to live in such interesting times. This is, you know, it's a moment of profound acceleration. And it has, like, in every spot that you operate and occupy, there is something that is, I think, going to be dramatically changed by technology. And the best, people always ask me, it's like, well, what should my kids do? Or what do I think about education? And the main thing you need to design for is to be in a state of continuous learning and experimentation, because the underlying tools are changing so quickly. And so that's what we're doing inside of Arc organizationally. It's like we have to be like gearing the org so that we can use these tools efficiently to be smarter, better allocators of capital across private, you know, venture, public, the whole soup to nuts. And then that's, yeah, so that's the, I don't know, Arc pitch. And yes, I'm happy to come on in the future. There is, technology is so fascinating and fast moving. So
it's so fun. Yeah. And as a new father, honestly, like that whole education angle is like, that's something that I'm starting to really think about deeply. So it's an, it's an unbelievable change. But yeah, Brett, thank you so much for coming on, and I really appreciate you, brother. Thank you so much.
All right. Cheers. Welcome to fatherhood.
Thank you. Bye.